Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the By Yahweh's Design conference call for the 21st day of August, year 2019. I am Commander Dan, your host and chairman for this meeting of the House of Jacob Israel. The agenda for today's call is John Mark Returns, and we put out a notice earlier today that if you go to John Mark Says, and that's all together with no spaces, johnmarksays.com/blog, you'll see some interesting articles that will pertain to tonight's discussion. Before we get into the discussion, we do dedicate this call to our Heavenly Father Yahweh, who is the great I Am. We also dedicate this call to His holy remnant, who are the believing sons and daughters of Jacob, who was later named Israel. Today, these people are known as the Caucasian or the true Israelite peoples of the world. Hallelujah, which means all praise Yahweh in ancient or Paleo Hebrew. To my Welsh kinsmen across the ocean, Shumai, and welcome to the program, Cumru Ambith. Callers will be welcome at a later time in the program. We do ask that you keep the comments or questions as short as possible so that others can participate. We are in the question and answer mode, and our website is www.pastordan.net. And that's where you'll find call schedule, archives of past calls, news items, learning references, and even information about weapons and ammunition, things such as that. Before we get any further into the program, tonight I'm using a new beta version of software for a free conference call. It was tested earlier today, but being a new program, there is a little bit of a learning curve on it because the screen is nothing like what it was before. So if anybody out there that's tuned in on their computers could type into the message window whether the audio is getting out there okay or not, because again, this new beta version is quite a bit different than what we used to use. I told John Mark to go ahead and call in about 2 or 3 minutes, no sense listening to the introduction all the time. One of John Mark's recent quotes that I really, really liked, he came out with, I think, a couple of weeks ago, "Nothing can stop the unified grassroots right." Why? Because it's the largest army in the world, numbering over 100 million in the United States, armed people, by guesstimates. There's no way of actually knowing, but by guesstimates. Verse for tonight is out of Psalm 42, verse 8. Yahweh will command His loving kindness in the daytime. In the night, His song shall be with me, a prayer to the Elohim God of my life. Hallelujah. There is an awful lot of stuff going on right now. I mean, we're being flooded with information on a daily basis, and I hate to say it, but I think a lot of it is hocus pocus. Kabuki theater is what we like to refer to it as. They're playing us, they're lying to us, they're deceiving us, they're distracting us. It was interesting, just before airtime, I tuned in to Coach Dave Live for today. About 17 minutes into his program, he went on a rant, and I swear he sounded like he had been listening to By Yahweh's Design over the past 20 years. It really was amazing. He went into the fact of our bogus counterfeit money. I put some suggestions for his audience to go read Gary Allen's excellent book called None Dare Call It Conspiracy. Also to read the book by F. Tupper Saucy, and that's S-A-U-S-S-Y, F. Tupper Saucy, Miracle on Main Street. Excellent books. If you want two books to get you really started, they're small books, easy to read. none dare call it conspiracy, and don't buy the other one. Buy the one that was written by Gary Allen, and it's still available at Amazon, and so is Miracle on Main Street by F. Tupper Saucy. And John in Miami says, sound is coming in clear, and Angel in Texas says, good audio. So very good. We're happy to hear that. And again, this new beta version has some really nice features that I like that the old system did not have. So that's really, I see a lot of things that are quite different here, and I'm still trying to figure it all out. Oh, here we go. Okay, I got to slide this thing down here because we got John with us now, and I didn't even see that. So let me bring him onto the program. Okay, John, can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Oh, you're loud and clear. Excellent. Welcome. How you doing?
Perfect. Doing well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my honor. It's my honor. I'll tell you what. Now, you did an intro the last time, so I'm going to remind everybody listening, if they go into the archives, I think it was a couple months ago, you were my first-time guest. So, folks, go back to that program. Listen to the beginning of it. John goes into a bio instead of having him do that and reinvent the wheel tonight. I want to get going on some of the new stuff that's going on. Your latest couple videos, John, I thought were superb. So if you want, unless you have something else that you want to cover more importantly, let's talk a little bit about your new blog, part of your website, the blog window there, and how you're coming up with that new Civil War II video that you've been working on.
Absolutely, yes. Thanks for mentioning that. My website is johnmarksays.com. And there's a link right there in the menu to the blog, or you can just type in johnmarksays.com/blog. But I started it because, as Pastor Dan said, I've been on YouTube for a while, since end of last year, and built up a pretty good audience on there. But making videos is very time-consuming, as you can probably imagine, doing all the editing, et cetera. Especially the way I do them with a lot of pictures and stuff. So there's so much more that I can say and that the people that I'm involved with have to say that I can share with people in a written format, and I can write much faster than I can make videos. So there's literally several times the output with writing that is possible as compared to making videos, at least the way I make them. So I started the blog to say I want to share more things that are running through my head throughout the day, throughout the week, and that the people that I'm involved with are sharing that is helpful to people. And so I started that, and I've gotten good feedback so far, but hopefully that's another avenue where people can learn.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. And I've been had a lot of people contact me here recently wanting to know more about propertarianism, because I'm talking about it with almost everybody that I speak with, and also in many of my emails. So for some of the folks out there, if you want to give a little nutshell to them, they're just curious, how does that fit in with what we talk about mostly here, which is the biblical perspective? And in our last interview, we talked about how much propertarianism fits in very, very well with what we consider the scriptures. So if you want to, like an encapsulation form, what is propertarian's goal?
Well, that's a great question. And I do remember from last time talking with you that it really struck me that I really could not find any area of disagreement between propertarianism and what you and your group there teach as far as the Bible goes and all of that. It was remarkable the way it all lined up. And so propertarianism is something that a man named Kurt Doolittle has been working on for the last several years. He's a very successful entrepreneur, tech entrepreneur, started and sold companies, et cetera. But what he came up with, what he said inspired him was that he felt a turn like in the 1990s when the left just started repeating talking points over and over and over again, and they wouldn't take questions and they wouldn't try to even be logically consistent whatsoever. And he said the grassroots right wing we need something else. We need another level of, I guess you could say, understanding and ammunition here of what our ancient strategy is. And what the conservative instinct actually consists of. Because many times we'll say something in what you might call moral language. We'll say, that's bad, or instinctive language, like that's icky. And what he came up with was a way to express it that can be written into law with a really logical underpinning to it. So it's not just, well, we don't like this, so we're going to make a law. Because you can do that, but then it's easy to get taken apart later when somebody else comes along and says, well, we have more votes now, and you know, we can we want something else. And so if I had to describe it in a nutshell, it's the right-wing instinct written into law. And so there's three kind of innovative aspects to it, and I'll just mention them real briefly. The first one is a more complete definition of property than something like our current law has or that libertarianism would have, for example. And it takes into account all the different types of things that people value. So a simple example would be, I value the ability to send my child to a school where they're not going to be taught certain leftist propaganda or LGBT stuff or whatever. I value that actually significantly more than I value a pay raise. And so does our current law call that property? No, it doesn't. But we treat it as property because we're trying to defend it. So that's a simple example. The second aspect of it is just that the concept of reciprocity. The right-wing instinct in one word, if you had to put it into one word, would be reciprocity. And it basically is just it's an extension of the instinct of don't steal, don't be a parasite, don't take something you didn't earn. And it's just like the Bible says, for example, you don't work, you don't eat, right? And so a lot of people try to interpret the Bible and say, well, you're required to give all this free stuff to everybody. As far as I can tell, the Bible doesn't say that about government at all. It encourages us to do good works. But in any case, the central aspect is reciprocity. There's a very specific 4 or 5 point definition. And basically what it says is the job of rule of law, the job of government, is to ensure that when people and groups are interacting with each other, they do not violate reciprocity. Because if they violate reciprocity, you start to get people who are angry at each other. And you start to get retaliation cycles. And you start to get corruption and parasitism, which take your whole society downhill. So that's the second key. And then the third aspect of it is the recommendation that public figures not be allowed, or that public figures can be punished for lying blatantly to the public. So they don't have to prove that every single thing they say is true, because that's difficult, but they do have to demonstrate, if taken to court, that what they say does not, that what they say passes a few falsehood tests. So it's, you know, for example, you can't just lie by omission, right? That type of an idea. And so that would clean up this huge mess that we have with fake news and with everybody saying all sorts of things. And of course, we know our political enemies are cherry picking constantly. They just say, you know, they cherry pick something to say and they repeat it over and over and over again. And they never mention the counterpoint. They never mention the other information that clarifies things or whatnot. And so this would fix a huge problem. So I won't go into the whole details, but that's kind of the basic outline of it. It's Kurt Doolittle's writing an upgraded or more complete constitution to try to fill some of these holes that our enemies have been driving through, that the first constitution really wasn't. The original founding fathers took a lot of stuff for granted. And they never would have dreamed that some of this stuff would be going on. So that was 200 years ago. They did a good job with what they had. But it's an attempt to just improve our rule of law and improve our system, so that we don't have this corruption factory at the top and we don't have this huge parasitic mass of people on the left side of the political spectrum just trying to impose costs and not caring what effect it has in the long term.
Yeah, amen, amen. Well, I'll tell you what, I can tell from the calls I get and different messages and whatnot, people's tolerance level has about reached the end, and they're tired of the constant stream of lies and misdirection and all of that other garbage that's going on. My thing would be, yep, you know, we need to implement this, and how do we do it? We got to stop worrying about what these criminals in D.C. are doing, the criminals at the state level and the county level. There's criminals everywhere we turn. And what I like about propertarianism is that it does require accountability, which we don't have at any level of our society today, especially in our public servants. No accountability anywhere to be found. And so with proprietarianism married up with the different things like libertarianism and what we call identity theology and all this, we're all saying a lot of the same, very same things. And especially now, I don't know if you saw that article by Paul Craig Roberts that came out just the other day. He was talking about white genocide. I mean, it's reached the level where a former Reagan cabinet member, Paul Craig Roberts, is now talking openly about in-your-face white genocide attempt by the Bolsheviks who have invaded this country. I mean, we got to do something.
Oh, absolutely. It's very interesting to hear you say that as well, what you said right at the beginning of that part where you said the people you're interacting with are basically totally at their end of patience with these people. And the people I'm interacting with, I personally am the same way. It's like, okay, it's over. We cannot live with you. And I said that in one of my videos recently. The grassroots right is coming to a consensus that we cannot live with these people. We cannot teach these people because they don't listen for various reasons that I explain in my videos as well. And very soon, we're not going to be able to win any elections against these people because they're importing people from overseas that vote 70% left. And they're importing them legally, not just illegally, not just illegally. And so it's all coming to a head. And you're exactly right. The tolerance level is at the end. And there was something else you said at the end of that segment that I wanted to touch on as well. I'm trying to remember. We have no recourse. Our leaders are completely and totally divorced from any skin in the game. There's no accountability, as you said. That's the way to say it. And what proprietarianism does is it restores the ability for the people to take public officials to court for things like lying blatantly to the public. Now, we're not talking about, you know, taking your neighbor to court because he came over to dinner and he said something, that happened to be false, right? We're talking about public figures here, but restore accountability for what they say. And we can take the powers that be to court on aspects of what proprietarianism calls, quote unquote, the commons. So, for example, the high trust that we have traditionally had in Western society is now completely gone. Well, it's not completely gone because there's still kind of a skeleton of it left, but it's being torn apart by immigration, not because all of the people are bad, but because they have these instincts and they want to believe that white people are bad because they need to believe that in order to feel like they're not inferior, right? And all of this, there's all this psychology going on in their hearts and minds that causes them to just tell lies. And then the politicians, because there's no accountability, they have a huge incentive to just tell lies to get votes. And there's no accountability at any level. There's no way that the people can fight against the public figures just being a big corruption factory and a big lying factory. And that's what proprietarianism would restore to us. And some of this we used to have in the past in Western civilization. We had more recourse in some of our past systems. But it's just gotten to the point now where we have no more recourse, and so that needs to be fixed. And the last thing I'll say, I don't mean to do too long of a monologue, but you had mentioned about the implementation. How does this actually get implemented? Well, obviously, proprietarianism, or really any kind of a significant fix, is not going to be implemented in our current system. Our current system is totally broken, and I think you and your audience probably realize that. And so there's going to be some kind of a conflict because when the right wing can't win any more elections and they realize voting does no good, which it hardly does any good anyway anymore, but when they realize it's not going to do any good, there's going to be serious secession movements of red states. There's going to be very likely conflicts, physical conflicts of different kinds that I talk about in some of my videos and predict. But there's going to be a shakeout, and after that shakeout is when we have a chance to implement some of these improvements. And that's really my passion, is try to get people to think about what can we do better? How can we learn from our mistakes? What were the specific mistakes that we made that allowed it to get to this point? And how do we make sure we never make those again and instead implement a better system so that our descendants don't have to go through this whole thing again?
Yeah, it's ugly. I mean, it's extremely ugly. And I agree with that. I'm older. I've got 14 grandchildren, so
Oh,
I
that's
want
great.
to, you know, when I leave this world, I would sure like to think that we've done something to make it a better place, a safer place, because, quite frankly, it's going to hell in a handbasket. All right.
Oh yeah.
And
Oh yeah.
you know, so we got to do something. I guess the big question, you know, that's what everybody says, is how do we do this? I mean, how do we get it going? Is there a group? Is it going to be action? Is there going to be any violence associated with it? I mean, everybody is like scrambling. They know that we're on the precipice of something big happening. You can feel it in the air, the tension. The left is completely unhinged. They have no rational thought whatsoever. They have no integrity whatsoever. They are flagrant Bolsheviks, and they're basically flaunting the fact that they mean to take over this country exactly the way they did Russia and murdered over 100 million Christian men, women, and children. I mean, so, you know, while they got us all focused on a phony hoaxacost, okay, we've got an actual holocaust of white Christian men and women in Russia, the Ukraine, Serbia, China, and everywhere else where people were gunned down en masse to the tune of over 100 million, which, I mean, that's gigantic compared to this complete hoax that they got everybody focused on it that supposedly Germany did, when every engineer I've talked to that's actually gone over there and done studies and all, including Fred Lechter in his report, and he built crematoria and execution. That was his profession, execution methods for the state. And he went over there and he said it's a complete joke. None of those buildings was built. And the Germans were famous for being staunch engineers and building things to high standards. And he said those buildings are a complete joke. There's no way they could have been used the way you're saying. So you see how everything's a lie. They got us focused on a complete myth while we haven't paid any attention in our schools, in our universities, in our talk shows, in our academia, about 100 million plus white Christian men, women, and children.
Oh, well, it's the industrialization of lying. And I've really been thinking about this the last couple of days because, first of all, what you're saying is absolutely correct. And I'm sure your audience is probably already aware of this because you're obviously very aware of it. But what we're facing in the United States of America and in the West right now is communism. It is, and it's not as much economic communism, although that's mixed in there. It is racial and gender communism. It is the exact same thing that, as you say, killed 100 million people in the 20th century and ruined the lives of a billion people. The exact same thing. It's just instead of, you know, we hate the middle class and anybody who has more than us, it's we hate white people because they have more than us. And we hate straight people because, you know, they quote unquote held gay people back. So it's the exact same thing. They will act the exact same way that those other people acted, those other communists acted in the 20th century, if they get the chance. And if you doubt that, just look at how they talk. They openly state, Ocasio-Cortez said the other day in a tweet, I believe, if you want border control for the United States of America, you are a fascist. What she means by that is you are a Nazi. And what she means by that is you deserve death or jail if you want common sense border control for your country. So they are already talking like communists, and they are communists. And so I actually think this is going to be maybe a little bit of a funny sounding thing, but I actually think it's good news that the left is going so overboard. People like you and I and your audience, just we can't even fathom it. It's like, how can these people be so crazy? But we actually understand this dynamic now because we've seen it before. We saw it with the first communism, and we can analyze it. We know what it is. We know why they're doing it. We know that they're not going to listen, and we know why they're not going to listen. And so now we know that teaching is not a solution for them. Teaching is a solution for us because we want to learn. We're willing to learn. They are not willing to learn. They will never give it up. So it comes down to we have to separate from them, and or simply defeat them in some type of a war. So I advocate for peaceful separation, as peaceful as possible, right? And so my prediction, this is where I get into the prediction of how could this actually be fixed. Well, it's a good thing that the left is going crazy because it wakes up anybody who's remotely normal. You know what I'm saying? If I was a leftist strategist, I would be telling people right now, I would be telling all the people on the left side of the political spectrum, everybody calm down. Stop calling people Nazis. Stop pushing LGBT on the kids. All we have to do is slowly boil the frog and keep immigration going, and we can win everything we want. That's what I would be telling them. But you know what? They're not capable of that. The grassroots left is not capable of stopping themselves from having this instinct of we want to crush everybody who's not like us. They can't stop themselves from being out-and-out communists. And you can see the higher-level people who have been around a while, like the Nancy Pelosi-type people who are just like lifetime grifters, and they just want to keep the grifting game going. You can see them kind of like they say this politically correct stuff because they know the base wants to hear it, but they're also kind of like, oh, my gosh, what did we unleash? We told all these non-white people that they're fantabulous and they have halos around their head just because they don't have white skin and that white people are evil, and that we told them that to get votes, and now they actually believe it, and they're actually acting like it, and they can't rein it in, see? So this is actually doing us a favor because it's waking all the people on our side up. It's really, really good news. You know, I thought it was good news when you told me all the people you're interacting with are totally fed up, because that's what I'm feeling too with all the people I interact with. So it's waking people up. So what's going to happen is the next shoe to drop is people realize Texas is going purple. And very soon, Trump is the last Republican president, whether he wins in 2020 or not. When the entire grassroots right figures that out, it's going to suddenly you're going to see very, very serious secession movements in red states, because there's some of that going on now, but it's not super, doesn't have a lot of traction. That will get traction really fast. And then there will likely be conflicts around that. You could also see the grassroots right wing start some fourth generation warfare in big blue coastal cities, that type of thing. I talk about that in my video, Civil War II, Who Would Win, which now has over 1 million views because there's a huge appetite. This will tell you something too as well, Pastor Dan. That term, civil war, that search term has, depending on where you look, between 500,000 and 1 million views or searches every month on YouTube/Google. I don't know if it's just YouTube or if it's YouTube and Google, but it tells you where people's minds are at. They know that we can't, even people on the left realize we can't live together. So this situation we have right now is not going to last. This system is not going to last because it contains the seeds of its own destruction. And then that's why I say I always keep going back to we can't just let this happen to us and like stumble around afterwards. We have to have something that we're ready to implement and have some solid ideas about what we're going to do and not do after the fact, because what we're in right now is not going to last. It cannot hold. It will not hold.
Yeah, I agree. When do you think you'll have that video ready, that part two on your Civil War?
Now, I just got a one-week ban from YouTube for another video that I put out, because what I didn't realize happened is that after the dual shootings in El Paso and Dayton, these social media, at least Facebook and YouTube, suddenly got much more sensitive about any content around that. And so I never say anything illegal. I never call for violence. I never do anything like that. But you know what the censors are like. So they're either using it as an excuse to censor right-wing people more, or they're just kind of naturally more sensitive about it. I mean, to me, that kind of stuff is totally predictable. Like, this really surprises you that there's shootings, you know, with the atmosphere we're in. It really surprises you that somebody would go around and start shooting Hispanics. You know, yeah, we don't want that. Please don't go do that. That doesn't help. But it's not surprising. But to a normal person, they're like, oh my gosh, you know, this is so terrible or whatever. And yeah, it is terrible, but it's not exactly surprising to me. So I didn't pick up on the fact that YouTube got extra sensitive about that stuff. And so they took that video down. They gave me a 1-week ban. I've appealed it. I haven't heard back from them. But just so everybody's aware out there on YouTube as well, especially, to be careful around that kind of stuff. And so that 1 week ban, I think, ends on Sunday. So hopefully I can put something out Sunday. And if not, it would be as soon as I can after that.
Okay. Well, excellent. Looking forward to it. We need to start uploading our stuff onto these other platforms like BitChute, because you just can't trust, and I promote BitChute because that's what I use. So I try to get as many people to go over there and just start paralleling out around YouTube and just get people slowly used to going over to BitChute instead of YouTube. And eventually we can just abandon YouTube altogether.
Yeah, that's great. I'm doing that too. I'm backing up all my stuff on BitChute. And I think even for this video that we're talking about, the video is going to be called Civil War II in America, What Comes After? And so it just lays out some of what it could look like just to get people thinking about it. And but I might put out kind of a YouTube version of that and then a BitChute version that is longer and more detailed and has more, more of what I'd really like to say. And again, none of it is illegal. Just to try to tiptoe around YouTube's censors.
Right. If the Bolsheviks have their way, any kind of dissent or any kind of exposure of what these communists are doing will be illegal, just like it was in Russia. In fact, when they got total control, they made it a capital offense to speak outwardly about the Bolsheviks being Jewish and what the Jews had to do with the Bolshevik Revolution, because it was not a Russian revolution. It was a Jewish Bolshevik Revolution. So just stating that could get you put up against the wall and shot. So this same mentality is here. So I've told all my friends, legal schmeagel. I mean, what does that mean anymore? When the Bolsheviks own the courts, they've got your government by the throat, and they're pumping either shekels into them or threats on them to where they're completely impotent, we're on our own. I mean, we have literally reached the point where we're on our own, at least in my point of view.
Yes, and you're right. If we look at this dynamic, the cycle that happens is they shut down right-winger speech, and then what does that incentivize right-wingers to do? Does it incentivize right-wingers to hash things out by talking? No, it doesn't, because they can't talk. Politics is just a proxy for war. That's all it is. And when you remove people's ability to talk, you're basically saying, okay, we're just pushing this into the realm of war now, physical war. That's what it is. And so, but the reason they're doing it is because they feel they have no choice. They have no control over the narrative anymore for at least half the population. We all noticed, I'm sure you noticed, starting a few years back, all these major news sites started taking down their comments sections because they couldn't control the narrative. You see what I'm saying? They're doing their leftist cherry picking, just like you're saying. They're trying to control what people can say and think, and it was falling apart because of the internet. Thank God for the internet. And it's not like the days of three or four news channels anymore, and you get to choose between Peter Jennings and Tom Brokaw, and that's pretty much it. People can find things out now. People can find you. People can find me. And so the narrative is falling apart, so they feel they have no choice but to do this, even though the smart people at the top have got to know the consequences of this. But they're playing the only card that they are able to play. And they're getting more and more desperate in doing it. So to me, it's actually good news, because if they had other cards to play, they'd be playing them. But this is all they can do, is just try to control the narrative, and they can't. They're losing. So it's all good news, because it all plays into our hands. And sometimes people hear me talk in this optimistic way, and they're like, how can you be so optimistic? It's because, as you said at the beginning, I came in just as you were saying it, the grassroots right wing is the largest army in the world. If the grassroots right wing in America decides to do something, nothing can stop them. 2/3 of the military is grassroots right wing. Every single ounce of institutional power that the left and the elite parasites have rests on men with guns enforcing it. And the men with guns enforcing it, meaning the military and police, and men with guns, which is way more people than even the military and the police, being law-abiding. But when the laws don't, when the laws persecute us rather than protecting us, what incentive do all those millions of men with guns have to continue to be law-abiding? None. And so the left establishment has no enforcement arm at the end of the day. Yes, they're very good at institutional power, and that's what we kind of see every day. Like, they're closing the walls in on us, but it all depends. All power eventually, at the end of the day, flows out of the end of a gun.
Yeah,
guess who has all the guns?
Yeah, Mao Zedong said that. All political power comes from the end of a rifle. And he ought to know he's a bloody damn Bolshevik communist. And that's why our side needs to wake up. I think it was John F. Kennedy that said, if peaceful revolution is suppressed, it will basically force violent revolution. Something, I'm paraphrasing, of course, but...
Yes, that's very close.
Yeah, very close to that. He just said it. Basically what's happening, if you suppress the conservative Christian white voice in America, who founded this country, by the way, in case, I know they don't like hearing that, but we founded this country. If you suppress that voice, you will force violent revolution. Now, maybe that's what they want, because they think they can win it. They think they can get the races to fight each other almost to the death, so that there's so few left over that the Bolsheviks, who are pretty much cowards, come in with their panty-waist IDF forces and whatnot that have to wear Depends because they're such cowards, that they can come in and mop up the few bodies that are left. You know, it's not going to be easy like when they took over Russia. You know, a lot of us have read Alexander Solzhenitsyn's two seminal works, 200 Years with Us and Gulag Archipelago. Okay, you read those two works of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and if your blood isn't boiling, you don't have 1 ounce of integrity in your body. There's no testosterone left in your body at all. I mean, it's... And then my friend in Canada, Gurchun Zigalar, who was a guest here a few months back, he's just finished a book. I got to see the manuscript yesterday of it, called Satan's Children, and it's along the lines of an Alexander Solzhenitsyn, only obviously much newer and with some newer stuff and better graphics and things like that. So the way the Bolsheviks do things is becoming much easier to obtain for the average person, and I believe within the last couple weeks, it seems like, John, I've been contacted by a lot of people. For years and years, guys like us have been trying to talk, and it felt like we was talking to a wall. It really did. It just, it was like an immovable object. It was just impossible to get anybody to give a damn, to listen or whatever. All of a sudden now, it's like it's turned, because now people are contacting us for more information. I've seen a lot of YouTube channels all of a sudden pop up by younger people saying a lot of the things that we're saying. And I was recently contacted by some older, very well-established folks, I won't say where, that are thinking along the same lines we are. And these are people that are, like I said, extremely well-educated, extremely well-connected, and they have a vested interest in working with guys like us to make a difference. This is the first time in 20 years of broadcasting, this is a first for me. And so I would have to go along with you. I think the left has overplayed their cards, and the wake up now is in like hyperspeed compared to what it's been for two decades prior to this. So we're going to see a lot of things going on. And I think guys like you, who are very articulate, very rational, you do great videos, you know, you're going to be like instrumental in providing these newly awakened neophytes to basically common sense on how we can turn this damn thing around. We just got to get back to the basics, and we got to walk away from the Bolsheviks.
that's exactly right. That's great to hear, and it's very interesting as you're talking it's dawning on me even further, the dynamic of what you're saying, of how people like you and people like me, and I mean, I'm relatively recent to waking up to this kind of stuff compared to somebody like you. I'm maybe, you know, 8 years into it or something like that from when I really started my journey of paying half attention to what's going on. But what's happening now is pain and fear of what the left is doing are driving people to people like you, people like me. And it's no longer like talking to a brick wall, they're open ears, because previously they were comfortable. If the threat's not very big, people like you can see the threat coming far off because you're really paying attention, right? But the people you're trying to reach, maybe they're comfortable, they don't really see any big threat. Well, now the left is going exponentially crazier by the minute. And people are looking around going, holy cow, all those conservatives that said slippery slope, were absolutely right. I mean, we got transgender people trying to chemically castrate seven-year-old boys. That's a news article I saw the other day that it's legit. I checked it out. This man is fighting. He's divorced. He's got three or four kids with his ex-wife. His ex-wife is dressing this boy, when she has custody of him, as a girl, and she wants to now chemically castrate him, which is permanent. And this guy is fighting in court so that his son doesn't get chemically castrated. Look around and we go, all right, let's just burn this whole thing to the ground. This is absolutely unacceptable. And so when normal people who would normally be comfortable and safe and say, don't talk to me about all that conspiracy stuff, don't be so antsy, now all of a sudden they're like, okay, I need a solution. And they're coming to you, they're coming to me. And that's really my goal. I loved how you said it. My goal is to try to create a streamlined way for people to learn, okay, this is where we went wrong. We made this mistake, and this mistake. And suddenly they're open to learn, whereas before they'd be like, oh, come on. Like, I'll give you an example. We have now learned that full franchise democracy is stupid. It's dumb because parasites get the same vote as a non-parasite. The homeless guy on the street gets the same vote as a productive worker. The guy who knows nothing, that's interviewed by Jay Leno on the street and doesn't even know who George Washington is, gets the same vote as somebody who's really well-informed. It's just dumb. And so, well, if you try to tell somebody that 15 years ago, they're like, oh, come on, democracy's the greatest. Now all of a sudden they're going, you know what? You got a point. So it's actually doing us a favor, as you said. The left is overplaying their hand. If you put it from the biblical perspective, the devil overplays his hand.
Amen to that. Yeah, their vanity. The prophets told us that their vanity would be their undoing. And in the end, the Father will take all of the devices of the wicked and turn it around on their heads only double. So everything they plan to do to the righteous is to be turned around and put on them double what they plan to do to us. And what they plan to do to us is pretty damn wicked. So if we get to turn it around and do to them double, I tell you what, I got a lot of volunteers. I've already been contacted by a lot of volunteers that are willing to go out and pour out double on these people. So as one military guy told me many years ago when I first started speaking to retired military and former special forces and things like that, they told me clear back then, they said, Dan, because I was trying to work out, stay in shape, to be a trigger puller, so to speak, and they would tell me in kind words, they said, look, you're an old man. You worry about logistics and education, we have enough trigger pullers. And this was over 20 years ago. So the trigger pullers are still out there. They've been waiting to see leadership, knowledge, a plan come together. And I think, like you said, people are beginning to realize that this is an extremely serious predicament that we're in. And they better pay attention here post-haste. Because Bolsheviks don't fool around. If they get to a certain point, they will try to pull a reign of terror, much like they did in Russia, because it worked. Okay, for them it worked in Russia. It terrorized all the common people into being quiet, putting their pitchforks down, putting their hatchets down. They had already been disarmed, so that's all they had left. But they didn't even realize it. Had they picked up those pitchforks and hatchets, they could have killed every one of the Bolsheviks because there was only a relative handful of them. But the reign of terror worked. Only now, praise Yahweh, that we have the internet, we have speakers like you and Kurt Doolittle and many, many other patriots out there saying, whoa, wait a minute here. Our forefathers gave us the Second Amendment for a reason, and we're learning today why the Second Amendment's there. We are literally seeing it today. I got to ask you, John, because I respect your intellect, your background, the people you associate with. I get a really good vibe with everything around you. I've got to ask you, me and many of the people I know, what the hell is up with Trump? Is he good or not? Because I'll tell you what, my radar is going off lately with some of the crap that I hear coming out of Washington and coming out of him. My radar is going clear off the charts on the red side. Give me your take. I know nobody knows 100% for sure, but just your gut feeling, what the hell's going on with that guy anyway?
Excellent question, and I don't claim to have, you know, the final answer, because it's a little bit like mind reading, but if we just look at the evidence, and you're right, it's like whiplash. You know, if you're a grassroots right-winger, part of Trump's base that really pushed him to be elected, it's like whiplash. It's like one minute he says something great, the next minute it's like, whoa, now you're talking about red flag laws? What is going on? So the best take that I can give is that he is operating in two modes. One mode is, I want to win the 2020 election. And the second mode is he's trying to govern. And so I'll explain both those modes. The first mode is he does want to win the 2020 election. And in order to do that, he has to reach a certain amount of the center independent type voters. He knows he's not going to reach the far left, which most of the left is now very far left compared to what they used to be, if you look at the surveys of the beliefs that they have. But he knows he has to reach a certain amount of the independents. He has to reach a certain amount of the soccer moms. So he has to say stuff that they like to hear. So I think I've noticed a pattern with him, and I was telling my wife this last night, or tonight actually, that something will happen, and he will say something that he knows the center will like. But then he doesn't follow through on it, or he kind of backpedals off of it later. And so his base initially is like, oh, no, don't say that. And then after he backs off of it, his base picks up on that. And they're like, well, he's not really doing that. Or he said something that means he's backing off of it. So he did exactly this with the red flag laws. And my guess is that he does that kind of thing on purpose, because he knows the center doesn't pay as much attention to politics as his base does. So he knows he can play this game. He's done it several times now where he says something the center likes, and then he does not do anything about it, or he kind of backs off of it, like he's backed off the red flag laws a little bit. You know, it's like, well, it's mental health and all this stuff. So that's one thing I think he's doing, and we don't like it. We just want somebody to speak the truth and be on our side, but he's playing this electoral politics game. I think the second thing that's going on is he is actually trying to govern more than you and I would like him to. We wanted somebody to go in and be a total wrecking ball to the corrupt people in Washington, right? And he's more kind of trying to manage it. You know what I'm saying? And I think if I had to guess why he's doing that, it's because he's very rich. His family is very high status. Like, for example, he said Melania, and he just said stuff too, so it could just be that, but he said Melania is the new what's her name? Jackie Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I don't care if my wife's the new Jackie Kennedy. I want to crush my enemies. You know what I'm saying? I don't care if your wife is the new Jackie Kennedy. But and he just talks like that, you know, it could just be that. But I think he's trying to govern more than you and I would like him to. Now, maybe he gets in for a second term, he gets the wrecking ball out more. But a lot of us are sitting here saying, where's the wrecking ball, man? And I have a hunch that some of it is just because of his situation in life. He and his family have a lot to lose, and people like that tend to favor the status quo more than people like us. So that is my two-part take on Trump, and I don't claim that it's the final word, but I think that might be a part, at least, of what's going on.
Okay, in relation to that question, I'm going to hit you with number two. Do the white hats, particularly the military white hats, exist? Do you actually believe that there is a group that is made up of the conservative grassroots, the same as us, within the military that's trying to do a counter coup against the Bolsheviks. Do you believe that's going on or not?
Well, the first thing I'll say is I don't know anything about Q. That is something I have not looked into, QAnon, that whole thing. I am not an expert on that whatsoever. I'm just too busy. My take is if it happens, I will cheer it on. And if it doesn't, you know, it doesn't. But and that's fine with me if people want to look into that. So I don't know anything about that. But I can say with confidence, well, let's look at the data, first of all. 2/3 of the military voted Trump. So we know that a majority of military people are basically on our side. And the rest of the military is probably not your snowflake commie types for the most part. Maybe there's some, but they're probably just more like, you know, your classic liberal type person that we would think of, you know, before the craziness started. So the other thing we can say is, with pretty good confidence, the more rank and file, the more grassroots right-wing the people in the military tend to be. The government has very purposefully, and they did this a lot under Obama, the government has very purposefully tried to get more senior leaders in the military that are can you still hear me okay? I've just had a couple calls coming in on my phone. There's no problem.
Yeah,
right?
You're coming in loud and clear, yeah.
Okay, so the higher level people in the military, they very purposefully tried to get people who are more on board with the social justice warrior agenda and this whole leftist thing. Now, I've heard a lot of anecdotal evidence from people who have emailed me and people who are in the military now who have been in the military relatively recently, and they said that a huge percentage of the military folks, especially the rank and file, hate this social justice warrior stuff, and it's really hurting morale, and they're angry about it. And the last thing I will say, so that's things I'm pretty confident I can say. And then the last thing I will say is, and I'm not an expert on this, but there was a report that there was a coup attempt during the Obama years by some people in the military, and it got found out and shut down. So I'm not an expert on that. However, if something like that happened, it wouldn't be surprising, even during the Obama years. I mean, you and I think back to the Obama years, and it seems like relatively normal now. You know, it's got all gone crazy since then. So if that happened then, the military folks now, with everything that's going on, I just can't see the military going along with, if you get some kind of crazy leftist president in there, I can't see them just doing whatever the leftists say or going around confiscating guns or, you know, fighting against Trump supporters, many of whom are, you know, their family and friends. I just don't see that the left establishment has the military rank and file on their side at all. They may have some of the top-level people, but you've got to have everybody obeying down to the bottom to really be effective as a military, and I just don't see that they would have that. And as far as whether there's – I'm sure that there are white hats in the three-letter agencies and in the military that what you and I would call white hats that are really trying to figure out a way to combat some of this stuff, and I don't know to what extent they're organized, to what extent they have a plan, but I can tell from the data that the white hats would exist, at least in terms of their way of thinking.
Okay. I've got a couple more questions here for you. I'm talking to some folks that may be putting a very large event here in the Southeast in the very near future. They're talking about renting a 10,000-seat auditorium. If I talk to them and they agree to it, would you be interested in being a speaker at that event?
I would definitely consider it. The only thing that I would have to consider is do I want to keep my identity private still or not? But I would love to do that at some point. I do want to come out from behind the motorcycle helmet, so I would just have to consider that. But that's one thing that I think we really can do, is start together with meetings and gatherings like that. I think that's a fantastic idea. If you look at the Trump rallies are really, it's kind of like the grassroots right wing's outlet, you know, to all be together. And I've thought for a long time that we can recreate that without Trump himself necessarily being there, and it could be a great thing. People can learn. You can have a conference with breakouts. You can do all sorts of different stuff. So I think rallies and events like that are fantastic, and I would definitely consider it.
Right, because the right-wing grassroots movement is what's important, not an individual. So,
correct, yeah.
So that's what people need to focus on. It's not Trump. I've been trying to tell people that for 3 years now. Trump is not what's important. What's important is what put Trump in office. The movement,
yes.
The people that are fed up, the real grassroots Americans that are completely fed up. Okay, another thing that we've talked about quite a bit here, and I want to get your opinion on if we can fit this in with propertarianism or not, is I'm in touch with people that want to greatly increase the efforts to educate the sheriffs of their constitutional responsibilities and powers. I talked with some folks that are in contact with Richard Mack, who was the founder of the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association. They claim that they have reached about 10% of the sheriffs in the country. And some of them are doing phenomenal works to protect the people of their county against overzealous, shall we say, federales and even state agencies. So if we can link up and with that effort, do you see that working hand in glove with propertarianism?
Oh, absolutely. I think that is an absolutely fantastic work that they're doing. If that's what they're doing, that is great, because two things come to mind. Number one, that's one of the most likely ways that conflicts could possibly start to happen. Especially once the right wing can't win any more national level elections, is the federal government could pass a law or do something, right, an executive order, whatever the case may be, and at the local level is where you'll see the resistance. So some of the states might resist it, and some of the sheriffs, of course, might say, no, we're just not going to enforce this. And then you can see the feds trying to make them enforce it, and you could see some conflicts beginning that way. But bottom line, the more knowledgeable the sheriffs are, the better. The other area where this really brings something to my mind that we talk about a lot in propertarianism is a militia. One of the things that we need to restore in the West, in America, in our lands, is a militia. And that's one of the things that we've lost. So in the old days, say you had somebody that did something really egregious in your town or in your neighborhood, right? Maybe they raped a little girl, or you know what I'm saying? It could be anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, many times the people of the neighborhood would just take it into their own hands and say, you know what? No. We're going to take care of business. You're not going to do that. And the people could mete out justice at the local level. And that's one of the things that we've lost. We've outsourced all of our capacity to punish evil to the government. And then the government itself becomes evil, and it's this big, massive federal government that rules over 330 million people. And, you know, many times they're the ones perpetrating now and enabling it. And so we've got to have more power and control for people to be able to, what we would call in propertarianism, police the commons, right, or keep the commons clean at a local level. And so I can see both before a conflict or some kind of a shakeout and after the local sheriffs being a huge, huge part of that. So I think that's absolutely fantastic.
Yep, and we've talked about that for years on the program. The local citizen soldier, some people call them militiamen, whatever, that's a very constitutional thing. It's a vital necessity to keep the land free. But it's also interesting because the word posse comes from the word posse comitatus, which is power of the county, right? And it's interesting that in the old days, the sheriff's office only had a few people in it, the sheriff and maybe a couple deputies. Because if there was a need for more guns to go stop bad people from doing things, they would call on the local militia to form a posse.
Absolutely.
And then the posse would go out with the sheriff. And typically, the posse would be made up of 12 men from the community. Interestingly enough, why 12 men? Because that's the same number as jurors. Because the posse serves two functions. The number one function is to make sure the sheriff is legitimate in what he's trying to do. That's your check on the sheriff if he's trying to do something wrong. Mm-hmm. And number two, if the answer is yes, the sheriff has proper jurisdiction, he's got a legitimate concern about what's going on, okay, now the posse goes out and apprehends the bad guy. And again, their job is oversight to make sure that, as in the case of who was the patriot that was gunned down by the sheriff? He wrote the Behold a Pale Horse. Bill Cooper.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
There's the perfect example of why we must have a citizen's posse go out with the sheriff. They went out there to Bill Cooper, who was a very outspoken patriot, who denounced a lot of the crap that's going on. And gee, lo and behold, Bill Cooper ends up shot dead. Okay. Mm. That wouldn't happen with a posse, with a citizen's posse watching what's going on. And that's why we got to do it. So I look at the militia being instrumental both in the protection at the local level, but also to be the enforcement arm to work with constitutional sheriffs so that we can get them back in line, and also that they know that we support them and will defend them as long as they're righteous in what they're doing. They have a standing army basically within the community anytime they need them, as long as they are legitimate and righteous.
I love what you're saying so much. That's one of the things that I want to ask Kurt Doolittle about when I interview him, hopefully here before too long, is what his vision of a militia would be, and have him flesh it out, what's in his mind. But what you're saying right there is, it's so powerful because that's what's been taken from us. All enforcement now basically comes from this very high level, far away set of rules, set of laws. And if those laws are good, I mean, that's fine, but they're not in many cases now.
No.
And do they care about our local community? No.
No.
You know, they just care about whatever their political agenda is or whatever that's completely removed from us. Whereas what you're describing is local men doing the enforcement. And when you have local men doing the enforcement, what's very close to their heart? What's very close to their heart is, what if this was my kid? What if this was my wife that this happened to? What is this person doing? And then I loved how you said, too, they can keep tabs on the local sheriff. If the local sheriff is telling them to do stuff that's just silly or bad or contrary to the interests of the group at the local level, they just say no. Or, you know, how about we lock you up, sheriff? You're going to be trying
exactly.
to do
that. Yeah, it reminds me of...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it reminds me of Athens, Tennessee, back in the 1940s, when the local sheriff, in league with the, I think it was either a county commissioner or the mayor of the city, they were stuffing ballots and throwing elections. And the local townspeople, who were returning veterans from World War II, got upset, and they went down to the armory and broke out all the military weapons, and they basically trapped the mayor and the sheriff and his deputies in a building and held them there until they got the ballot boxes back and held a proper election. But it got violent. I mean, there were guns shot. I think some people got hurt. But the people of Athens, Tennessee, said enough is enough. The other thing is, when I was a boy back in the 1950s in central Pennsylvania, I actually got to see what you're talking about in action. We had a little girl disappeared, a little blonde-haired girl disappeared, and it went through the whole area. The whole valley was up in arms. And who turned out? The men. The men turned out. There was very little police presence. The only thing the sheriff and the local police were there was to sort of just kind of oversee things and try to provide communications and a little bit of leadership. But the men in the woods with lanterns and rifles were the local country boys, like I said, that I grew up with, my father and people like that. They went to the woods, and they stayed in those woods until they found that little girl. Turns out she was kidnapped by a hermit. I don't remember if anything was put in the paper about what he did or did not do to her, but she was returned to her family. We do know that, and he was apprehended. But the men turned out in force with weapons, and they stayed in those woods until that little girl was found. That's the way it's supposed to work.
Oh, I love that so much. As you're telling that story, there's something happening in my emotions that it's a little bit hard to describe, but it's basically, I want to do that. I want to be part of something like that. There's something in a man that rises up and says, I want to protect my family. I want to protect my community. And it's one member, one man in the community saying to the other men in the community, and all of them saying it to each other, I will look out for you if you look out for me. I will help protect yours if you help protect mine. And that's the concept that we call in proprietarianism sovereignty. And there's a great phrase that Eli Harman was one of the leading proprietarians. I think it was him that came up with it. The distributed dictatorship of sovereign men. And that's what we've lost because the average man has lost the ability to protect his community because everything's outsourced to this big faraway government that obviously doesn't give a flying rip about us.
No.
And so when we restore that, when we have a militia, and there's other great benefits to this as well. So you have young men, you can either require them to take part in the militia or make it voluntary, however you wanted to do it. I don't know what would be the best way. It's one of the things I want to ask Kurt about. But if you have young men participating in the militia, for one thing, you're teaching them it is your job to look out for the commons. It is your job to look out for your local community. It is your job to look out for your fellow families in the community and your property and your public spaces. And if you see somebody imposing a cost on those things, it is your job to bring it to the group, bring it to the local community, bring it to the sheriff, bring it to the other men, whatever the appropriate course of action is. But no more of this, you know, we're all just kind of mindless sheep. And we just rely on this big faraway government to protect us. No, it's every single man's responsibility. And as you said, it's the men. And this is another thing that comes back to, we've had women in the voting pool now for a lot of decades. And that's one of the main things that gave America a big leftward push. And as we talked earlier, voting is a proxy for force. So if women aren't the ones that are putting their lives on the line when something needs to be fixed, why are they participating in the proxy for that? If something goes wrong and it needs to be fixed, whose men are on the line? Whose bodies are on the line? The men's. And so I'm not saying you would necessarily have to say no women can vote. There's different ways to restrict who's voting to those who have skin in the game. But it's the concept that the responsibility is really on the men at the end of the day.
Amen.
And I love this idea of pushing it down to the local arena.
Amen. Amen. And let me tell you something as we go forward. I've spoken to a lot of personal friends, family, etc., females, and I have not found one yet, not one yet, that would object to doing away with women voting because they've said personally, I don't care about politics. I don't want to get involved with it. I don't want to get educated on it. I'd rather let the men of the family do the deciding. Every single one of them. So it's the Bolsheviks and their control of the media that's making us believe that women want to be part of this. The man haters, the Bolsheviks, they're the ones, not the average white Anglo-Saxon females. I've talked to many of them over the years, and not a single one of them had a problem with us going back to where the men get together, decide the direction we're going on, they'll decide, follow strong leadership, follow strong men, and ladies, you get in line, you know damn well we're going to take care of you, don't listen to the Bolsheviks and their line of BS, no, we'll take care of things, and we're going to take care of these Bolsheviks, I'm telling you, that's what I'm here for. I am here to destroy them, not placate them, not compromise with them. I am here to shed my blood to destroy them. That's my commitment. That's my promise to my family, to myself, and to my living God. My life's blood destroying these sons of bitches, because I am sick of it. I've read too much about what they've done. They've shed way too much blood, and now they're trying to bring down our country, and I say to hell with them. It's time to stop them. That's all there is to it. I wanted to read a quote by Richard Buckminster Fuller. I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, but it fits in with your proprietarianism. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. The new model is we're going back with the founding fathers' envision, which is embodied in proprietarianism. The men will become men again, and we're going to go out and destroy the Bolsheviks and restore our nation. How's that for a new model?
I love it. I love it. And you're right. A lot of it is actually, I mean, proprietarianism does have a new level of insights, but a lot of it is actually, as you say, just returning to what the founding fathers did, because we screwed it up. The founding fathers, the reason they set in place something resembling what you might call a democracy and they weren't afraid that it was going to go bad is because they did not envision women ever voting.
Right.
They did not envision men who were not adult, responsible, proven men voting. And so then we undid all of that stuff with all of these lies. Everybody's equal. Everybody's the same. And it's just not true. You can tell from the voting statistics, everybody's not the same. So I'd love to hear what you said earlier about how all or most of the women that you've talked to on the right wing, you know, people like us, they're fine with the men taking the lead. They're fine if they don't have a vote. Like, you guys take care of business, you know. And you can see that from the statistics. White married women with children vote a significant majority right wing. They voted significant majority for Trump. Single white women voted majority left, which is a very, very interesting dynamic. As soon as you get a family, as soon as you have kids, as soon as you have skin in the game, and you have to look your kids in the eyes and say, what is your future going to be like? My responsibility is to set up your future. Suddenly your time horizon gets stretched out. Suddenly you make much more responsible decisions, even in your voting. And so I think that's a really interesting piece of news that you shared along those lines. And I love that quote as well, setting a new system in place and just undoing some of these mistakes that we made.
Yeah, amen to that. And it's just like in the movie Field of Dreams. If we build it, they will come. I'll guarantee it. Now, here's another. I got another one for you here. This is something that I've talked about for quite some time and get a lot of debate and pushback, but I'm looking at it the fact that we're running out of time, and at some point we're going to have to rush into the field. We're going to have to go forward very, very quickly, and I can't see any other way, especially if things fall down quickly, other than at least on a temporary basis, going back to what I call a biblical monarchy. Now, let me explain. First of all, a monarch is not a dictator. Second of all, a monarch is elected. He's not because of birth or any other nonsensical thing like that. A biblical monarch is a member of the tribe, the family, whatever. He's elected into that position. He stays in there as long as he does a good job. The elders are put together as a privy council to make sure, just like the posse watches the sheriff, the privy council watches the monarch. The reason that the monarch is the most efficient form of government ever. Every person in academia that's ever looked into it has said the exact same thing. A beneficial monarchy is the most efficient form of government. So if we're in a hurry, I'm posing to you, why would not a monarch who says, all right, we have an enemy trying to destroy us. They have completely obliterated the process. It just no longer works. The political process is broke beyond fixing. Okay? Mm-hmm. All right, let's all elect a singular individual to make decisions, just like the commander on a battleship. You'll never find two commanders on a battleship. Why? Because you'll never get anything done. I think it was, I can't remember who had a quote, it said, one bad general is better than two good ones. Okay? So, same thing here. We've got all of these people trying to make decisions and come to a consensus, and we're dying. We're dying because the enemy knows that they can buy, coerce, bribe, blackmail, threaten enough to clog up gum up the works. Whereas in a monarchy, if the men at arms, the guys you're talking about, the men that still have testosterone in their bodies, if the men at arms say, we're going to go with this guy over here, he represents most, if not all, of the things that we hold value in, and we're going to follow him, and we're going to take back our country, much like King David in the Bible. He was mm-hmm. both a leader in civics, but he was also a leader of the military. And he combined that office and was able to accomplish great things. And that's why the Zionists, the Bolsheviks, said many years ago, one of the very first things they were going to do is destroy the Christian monarchies, because they represented an obstacle very difficult for them to get through. And so my question is, in your mind, can we marry the objectives of proprietarianism and identity into the idea of going forward with a military monarchy to get rid of our enemies and restore peace and prosperity under the rules of proprietarianism?
Fascinating question, and it's very interesting because this is something I don't bring up very often because I'm trying to kind of just communicate the basics usually of proprietarianism to people. But Kurt actually recommends, and I will be the first one to say Kurt has done more historical study on this than I have, but as far as I'm aware, what you're saying is correct, that if you have a beneficial monarch, that is a superior system to a, definitely superior to a full franchise democracy, right? And it's because of the incentives. So a monarch wants to pass a healthy nation or a healthy group down to his descendants to rule over, so he has a strong incentive to make sure that he keeps the nation healthy and happy, right? Now, mm-hmm. of course, it can go bad. You can have corrupt rulers as well. You can have unintelligent rulers. And then the theory goes as well, well, you just have to get rid of one person or one family rather than the type of situation we have now, which is basically all our elected officials are just bought and paid for by big corporations, and it's a big, huge mess, right? So Kurt Doolittle has said several times, many times in his writing, that we actually in the West had something very close to the perfect system. And I'll do my best to describe it without getting it wrong. But it involves a monarch, but not a monarch that can do that has complete arbitrary power. Rather, a monarch that has some power, especially as kind of a decider or an insurer of last resort, and he has some discretionary power to spend money on certain things and do things that he thinks are wise. But then you also have a constitution or a contract, and then you have different houses of government that can negotiate with each other. And again, it's not just everybody voting willy-nilly, and it's just like raw numbers, right? Mm-hmm. And so he, I'm sure, could do a much better job of explaining to us, and I plan to ask him this similar question when I interview him. But he actually said that that's a very beneficial thing to have as a monarch. And obviously, as we all know now, full franchise democracy, where it's just, you know, mob rule of whoever can get the most votes by saying the thing that the, you know, media's people want to hear or whatever, that's disaster. So I think there's definitely a place for a monarchy. And again, as we were saying, people's pain is driving learning, and they're asking the question, how can we have a better system? And that's one aspect that could be better. And then the other thing I'll add on this is, as you were talking about, especially in a situation like we have now, where there's a crisis situation, this is a ripe situation for a strong man and or a monarch to rise up. So, for example, if Trump decided to just take matters into his own hands and send the military to the border and send the military around to do what needs to be done, what percentage of the grassroots right wing do you think would really protest against that if he basically said, I'm going to be a strong man now? I don't think too many people would complain, because the alternative is to have to fight the enemy, you know, without him, you know, without a strong leader like that. And mm-hmm. so these are the types of situations where strong men arise, where kings sometimes arise. So that is a not unlikely outcome of the situation we're in. The only other thing I'll add about that is, modern people, even most of the grassroots right today, I would say, they're very, very accustomed to a constitution. Like if we go in and say, we have an upgraded, updated constitution that is going to do a better job of ensuring that this doesn't happen again, I think you can very easily get a broad approval and broad support for that. Now, if you go in and say, we want a king, Well, if it's Trump, maybe. If it's somebody we've never heard of before, or somebody that's totally new and unfamiliar, I don't know. I'd maybe trust the Constitution more, might be kind of the general sentiment. So a lot of it depends on what can be sold to the grassroots right. But the answer to your question is, within proprietarianism, from what I understand, there could be a place for a monarch. And a lot of the challenge, and this is the challenge that proprietarianism meets better than anything I've come across before, the real challenge that you face with human leadership is, how do you eliminate arbitrary, corrupt, and or parasitic decision making at the high levels, where people are just acting for their own benefit because they can and screwing over the people? How do you stop that? And so rule of law is a great way to do that for large numbers of people. And if you can make your rule of law to where it is simply enforcing reciprocity, as we talked about earlier, that's what proprietarianism kind of teaches us how to do and gives us the tools to do. But then there are times when it, you know, you need a decision to be made and it can't be made, or something needs to happen fast. It's a crisis situation, it's a war situation, and you need somebody to be able to make that decision, and it can be helpful to have a monarch in place as well. So that's kind of a long-winded answer, but the short version is yes, there's definitely compatibility there.
Okay, very good. Are you up for taking a caller?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, now this is a beta version I'm using of this, so I'm going to switch presenters, get the caller, and then I'm going to bring you back on, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay, let's see how this works. All right, let's see. Ken, can you hear me? Okay, apparently that didn't work. Are you still there, John?
I'm still here.
Okay. Well,
I've been able to hear you the whole time.
Okay. I tried to bring on Ken, who says he has a comment, but again, I'm using a new beta version of this, and it's not. Okay.
I'm fine. I'm not in a hurry. So if you need to make it work, that's fine. But
it did not work. I'm going to have to do some more debugging of this thing here. It shows that he wants to say something, but then it's not allowed me to switch over. So, Kenny, if you did have something, send me a message on the little blog thing there, and I'll try it again if you really want to say something. But we'll just keep going on here. Okay, and you're right, okay? We need, whatever we come up with, it has to be able to prevent a tyrant, okay? Because that's what we have now. Mm-hmm. We have an oligarchy. We have an oligarchy mm-hmm. that has formed a tyranny in the kakistocracy that we're drowning. We're drowning in the absolute criminality of a kakistocracy by a dictatorial oligarchy. So there's a bunch of 25-cent words for everybody to run to their dictionaries with. But every one of them fits. It's just like George Washington's farewell address, okay? If you ever go to read George Washington's farewell address, you had better carry a dictionary with you, because whoever put that address together was a master of using the precise word. And so, again, an oligarchy and kakistocracy fit like a glove with the mess that we're in. So we got to prevent the tyranny. But here's the thing. We need to look at – we've got to stop looking at the negativity of everything and start looking at what would work. Obviously, we're about ready to drown. We're about ready to fall over to the Bolsheviks. This is serious. I mean, even Paul Craig Roberts and – many other commentators are talking about it, so even they are seeing it. We need to look at, well, what can be rapidly put together to go hand in glove with the citizen soldiers and the military white hats that would allow for us to defend ourselves and rid ourselves of these Bolsheviks and give us yet still a working form of government where it's needed. Now, what we have to understand is, under proprietarianism, which is in agreement with libertarianism and in agreement with the Bible, Government is to be at the local level. The upper levels are only for mitigation of problems or disputes. They're not dictators. They're not supposed to be in our lives with day-to-day decisions on what color of siding on my house, how much frontage I'm allowed to have. This is ridiculous. I mean, everything is managed down to the minute detail in our lives. That was not the image. It was whatever we at the local level think we need, we're fine. And then when we have disputes, that's when you get to the chieftain and the captain of 50, the captain of 100 families, the captain of 1,000 families, the captain of 10,000, all the way up to the monarch. The monarch doesn't get involved. He's only there for dispute resolution, and only, as it was in the case with Moses, only in those cases that couldn't be solved at the lower levels. So that's the concept we need to keep, and I think it can be done. I think it can be done and put in a righteous man, a strong military-type man, righteous man, who exemplifies the things that we're talking about, bring in the precepts of proprietarianism, bring in the biblical theology, marry the two together along with the citizen soldiers, and bingo, I think you got a winning combination.
Absolutely, and I completely agree it can be done. I think that there's enough people that understand the basic concepts that you're talking about there of localization of decision-making as much as possible, and then the dispute resolution goes up through the courts, whatever the case may be, goes up, you know, whether you have your chieftain's right or you have a legal system that it goes up through. And I think where proprietarianism really adds a lot of value is it gives the legal system a very specific jurisprudence. And that's one of the problems with our current constitution is the original constitution. It does not lay out an extremely specific jurisprudence that the judges have to follow. And so they are doing this activism from the bench. And so the constitution that Kurt is writing is actually already very pretty close to being finished, from what I understand. As well on its way, and it lays out a very specific jurisprudence, and basically all the judges are doing are deciding if there's a violation of reciprocity according to a very specific definition of reciprocity, a very specific definition of property, etc. And you know, they're not doing activism. They're discovering if there's property violations and with a broad empirical definition of property. And so that's extremely valuable because it limits the abuse from the higher levels, if that makes sense. You can have a lot of the decision making at the local level, as it should be, and as it goes up the chain, when necessary, you don't have. I mean, right now, I feel like if you have a case that goes to court, it completely depends on what judge you get. Are you going to get a leftist activist judge, or are you going to get somebody that rules constitutionally? You never know, right? Because the ones who don't rule constitutionally are not getting impeached, because it's not clear enough, and they can just use fancy words to make it sound like it's okay. And so this adds a lot of clarity. And then the only other thing I will add there is I'll throw out another word, another 25-cent word for you and your audience, nomocracy. Nomocracy is basically rule of law, where natural law is making most of the decisions. And anybody that violates natural law gets their rear end handed to them in court. And so there's basically two ways that these decisions can be made at any level. And that is somebody just arbitrarily decides. And so if the person is good, that's fine. If the person is bad, either unintelligent or unwise or corrupt and selfish, it can be bad. So how do you eliminate the bad? And even if you have good people making the decisions, the bigger your group, the more good people you have to have in place. And it's hard to find tons of good people that would be good at this kind of stuff. I mean, you can find them. We have them. But at some point, you're either going to have arbitrary decisions being made over and over and over by the millions, or you're going to have a system that dictates how those decisions are made. And proprietarianism gives us that system, which is basically a very specific definition of reciprocity and a very specific definition of property. So there's that guideline to where people can say, okay, now I know how to think about how to make this decision. And now the regular people have a standard by which they can compare the people that are making the decisions. Are these people making decisions that are violating reciprocity and allowing people to violate reciprocity, or are they enforcing reciprocity? And it's easier to keep people accountable as well, because there's a very clear way of thinking about it. So I think it's completely possible, as you said. We know, one of the things I say is we know what to do now. There's a critical mass of people on the grassroots right wing that know what to do. We know how to make something and build something way, way better than what we have now. And it's just a matter of getting there. But the good news is we know what to do.
Yeah, amen to that. Well, part of the solution, of course, is to get the courts back to what they originally started out being, which was just a platform where two neighbors who have a dispute would come before the jury, which is made up of other neighbors who know both people, not this goofy system we got today. The jury is supposed to be your peer, which means he knows both parties. He's familiar with their habits, their character, their integrity, their past performances, which only makes sense. So you come before 12 men of the community and present each of you completely unencumbered. You get to come in there and present your case against each other, and the jury decides. The judge is only a referee. That's it. He has no power whatsoever. Mm. His only job is to make sure there's order in the court. That's it. He has no say on what's brought in as evidence. He has nothing to do with it other than maintaining order in the room so that there can be a presentation by both parties unencumbered before the jury, and then the jury makes up the decision on guilt or innocence, not the judge. That's wrong.
Yes.
In fact, we shouldn't even be calling them damn judges. They should be called referees. In fact, take that damn robe off of these sons of bitches and put them in a black and white shirt like the guys on the football field. Because that's all they are. Referees. That's it. Give them a whistle. Give them a black hat and a black and white shirt, and sit your ass behind that bench, and when somebody's out of line, just blow a whistle. Other than that, you don't mean a thing. There's nothing special about you. We sure as hell don't need lawyers in there, because almost a milkman can figure out when a courtroom is in order and out of order. So we don't need lawyers in there. We just need black and white striped shirted referees, and let us do the talking, and then let a completely impartial panel of 12 peers, meaning men, make the decision. Not these black-robed pieces of garbage that like to think of themselves as if they're better than anybody else, and that the courtroom belongs to them. You pompous asses. I am so sick of hearing that. That courtroom belongs to we the people, not you pompous asses.
Yes, and then when you have your peers, and I want to say something about that in a second, because I love that. It's so true, it's the peers. Actually, I'll start with that. You remember the O.J. Simpson trial, obviously. There is a documentary that came out fairly recently, last few years, where they went back and they talked to some of the jurors that were on that trial. And basically, the lawyers both knew this whole trial is going to come down to who sits on the jury and what their race is. If they're black, O.J. is going to get off. If they're not, there might be some semblance of a fair trial. And one of the jurors actually said it straight out. This is many years later, obviously. She said, you know, back then we just looked out for our own. I mean, she's basically saying she didn't even really listen. All she did was just vote for letting the guy off because he's the same skin color as her.
Right.
So, you know, these jurors are chosen from wherever. It's totally random, right? You have to have a jury of peers, of people from your local community. And it is sort of like that, I guess. But the system is broken to where, especially when you have so much atomization in society and people aren't really peers in the sense of being part of the same community because they just have totally different views or whatever. And so the jury of peers is hugely important. And then when you have a jury of peers, as you say, you still have to have a law that makes sense, because even if there's no lawyers, if there's lawyers or no lawyers, the two sides are going to be arguing about, was there a law that was broken? And if so, what is that law? What is the definition of that law? you know, what defines whether the person is guilty or innocent? Well, what defines it is the law. So the law has to be written right. And another problem is a lot of our laws are not good. And we actually have really good rule of law compared to most places on earth. But obviously there's a lot of things that are broken about it. And so if the law says it's okay to teach LGBT to five-year-olds, well, what recourse do we have? So the law has to be right too. And that's where proprietarianism makes a huge provides a huge benefit in my mind as well, because it makes it very simple actually, and it makes it so that it's very hard for our enemies to walk into a courtroom and pretend that what they're doing is okay, because it exposes immediately, no, everything you do is a violation of reciprocity. Everything you do is some kind of a parasitism or imposing a cost on some form of valuable property, not just individual property in some cases. So that's the other thing that it provides, and I'm completely with you. We need to fix it.
Well, that's where jury nullification comes in, and also the proper jury instructions. Up until a few decades ago, a judge instructing the jury told him what the founding fathers demanded that the referee. He was supposed to tell the very first job of the jury is to judge the law. Mm. You don't go to the person, the defendant, until you judge the law.
Mm.
Okay? And that's the other thing, too. The state should never be in a courtroom. The state doesn't exist. The state is a fiction. The only people that are in the courtroom are living bodies. And if living bodies don't have a reason to be there, the state has no reason. So, first of all, that's a fiction. The state claiming that they have a right to bring anybody into a courtroom is a lie. The state is a fiction, therefore it has no jurisdiction whatsoever. The second thing is a proper jury of Christian men would be sitting there going, well, first of all, this law, wait a minute, LGBT is immoral, goes against the common law, the natural law, therefore your law that these bunch of Bolshevik lawyers up in some Capitol building put this on paper, sorry, but it doesn't matter. It's not law at all. Even William Blackstone said that. If a law is generated by any legislative body and it goes counter to natural or God's law, it's no law at all. It has no effect. No effect at all. Mm. Because our Creator already established the law. Man only has the right to write statutes and regulations to assist in enforcing God's law. That's it. We don't have rights to say that homosexuality is okay, or dressing up 11-year-old boys in drag, or some woman has a right to chemically castrate anybody, let alone her own child.
Seriously.
That's ludicrous.
Yeah. Just fixing some of these basic things. I mean, these are just basic things that have gone wrong. And, you know, there are huge secrets of Western civilization as well. A lot of places didn't really develop this. You go to third world countries, they really struggle with rule of law. It's basically whoever can pay off the judge the most money, right? Or pay off the jury, or threaten to kill the jury if they don't rule in favor of whoever's got the most, you know, corrupt gun power, or the cartels, or whoever it is. So they really, really struggle with this. So in the West, we've had something that's way, way better than most of the world, but there's just aspects of it that have gone seriously wrong, and a lot of it is just getting back to the basics. And I love how you're talking about the concept of the localization as well, and the responsibility, restoring the responsibility to the men of the community, and not everything outsourced to this big big, massive organization that develops incentives all its own that have nothing to do with our well-being.
Right. Amen to that. Well, I've had you on for over an hour and a half, so you might be getting a bit tired. But I think we covered most of the points we wanted to tonight. Did you have anything else you want to add before we close it up?
No, just wanted to say thank you for having me on. I really appreciate both times that I've had the opportunity to chat with you. I just really love your your insight into these things and your passion for it, and it just always heartens me. Both times that I've interacted with you, that there's men like you out there, men like you of your generation that are really fighting the good fight for us and willing to do whatever it takes. So thank you for doing what you do as well.
Well, thanks a lot, John, and bless your heart and keep up the good work. We'll do this again soon, and let me know as soon as that video gets out. I think I'm on your notifications because I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
It may be Sunday at the earliest. If not, maybe next week or the next weekend, hopefully at the very latest. But, yeah, we'll get it out for you guys.
All right, John. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, again, that's John Mark, and I would highly recommend you go to YouTube and BitChute and look for John Mark, his channel, and subscribe to it. Put yourself on the notifications for it. You're not going to be regretful of doing that. A very, very well-rounded young man with great connections, great insight, and a lot of good information there. This is where we need to go. We need to get the best of the best and get everybody in the canoe rowing in the same direction. That's been the problem we've had. We've allowed the enemy to divide us on really kind of minute details. He's got, like I said, I've been to many gatherings where, oh, we're Saturday Sabbath people. We're Sunday Sabbath people. We're neither of those day Sabbath people. I don't like the way your women are dressed. I don't like the way your men are dressed. I don't like the food you eat. I mean, it's unbelievable the things that we sometimes allow for to divide us. The things that divide us is just unbelievable. Unbelievable. And we got to stop that. We definitely got to stop that. Now, I'm showing here that some people have a question, so let me see if this thing will work and we can take a couple of them before we shut this thing down. Again, I'm using a beta version of this thing. I don't know if I like this better than the one we had. It's not letting me see, this beta version is not as good as the old version as far as letting me bring somebody on to the call. This is ridiculous. So I'm going to have to give feedback to Free Conference Call and let them know their beta version sucks because it's not as good as the old version. It looks different. You'd think they've made improvements, but like so many things today, instead of improving it, it looks like they made it worse. So, but anyway, so if anybody has a question or wanted to make a question and you can't get on, I apologize. Again, I'm going to have to get with the Free Conference Call and get this bug removed. I think it's really great. We got 214 people we're listening in tonight, so that's really good, a couple hundred people. And so John Mark, again, go to YouTube and BitChute. His website is johnmarksays.com, johnmarksays.com. And if you want to go to his blog, there's a link there. Go to the blog where he posts a lot of his own material and the material of Kurt Doolittle. Because propertarianism is just following right in lines with the Founding Fathers. It's kind of like a marriage of the Founding Fathers, libertarianism, biblical teachings, and put it all together. It's basically natural law and common sense. And it sure as hell a great benefit and a great moving forward compared to the garbage we got today. That's for sure. So, dear Heavenly Father Yahweh, we give you the praise, glory, and honor, and thank you for this opportunity to share with one another and come together as a family. We thank you for the work of Kurt Doolittle and John Mark and their efforts to bring some sanity into this completely insane Bolshevik hell that we find ourselves in. We ask that you'd watch over your sons and daughters wherever you find them. If they're having problems with the health, then give them a healing. If it's an emotional, then rest their souls with the comforter of the Holy Spirit. If it's a finance thing, then look over us, Father, and help us in that area because the enemy is trying to starve us out. The Bolsheviks are making sure that everybody that's a pervert and an enemy of Christ has all kinds of shekels in their pockets, whereas the rest of us are struggling day by day. We also thank you for our listeners and supporters out there, and we also ask that you be with us and guide us in all that we say and do to thy glory and for thy kingdom. Forgive us our stumblings and forgive us our shortcomings and protect us from our enemies. We ask this in Yahweh's precious name. Hallelujah.